The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
One of the perplexing teachings of Buddhism is one that is sometimes called teaching of no self or not self or non-self. And it's very easy to get kind of entangled in philosophical considerations about what this means and to get into wonderful debates about what it means. And one of the most common concerns when people start hearing the teachings of not-self is to protest that this has to be absurd because I'm here. And what do you mean there's no self when I'm sitting right here in front of you? And the Buddhist way of presenting this teaching of not-self is not to offer it cold, like some great philosophy that you have to understand or believe. But the starting point in Buddhism is not who we are, but rather, do we suffer? And then, if we're interested in the alleviation of the suffering, of stress, of anguish, of, you know, the Buddhist word suffering is kind of a catch-all word for all forms of being uneasy or being troubled. If we're interested in being untroubled, have an untroubled heart, then it's a different starting point for our investigation. So if the task is not to suffer, then it's easy to start seeing that there are some ways that human beings suffer because of their self. Issues of self-identity, issues of what's mine, what's me, what's myself. There's a variety of ways in which people suffer. And if you start just kind of starting there with the suffering around this and then explore that deeper and deeper into us, you get to a clearer view of what Buddhism means by this teaching of not-self. And it frees the discussion from the philosophical debates about what it might be and what it isn't. Because it's not really about philosophy, it's about the alleviation of suffering. And so so if we start kind of at a very kind of most maybe broadest way place, one broad place is people suffer a lot around, some people, around their possessions. And so they identify very strongly with their possessions. Their possessions sometimes, they use them to define who they are. Sometimes their status is connected to their possessions. A variety of ways. And if they lose their possessions, they sometimes people feel lost. They don't know who they are. Sometimes people assign us identities because of our possessions. There was a time in the United States where you couldn't vote if you didn't own possessions, and if you weren't white. But there were, you know, so your possessions counted a lot for your status and who you were. And not a few people have either suffered or learned not to suffer by learned to suffer because of how they're attached to their possessions and how the possessions are a reflection of who they are themselves. And some people have learned a dramatic form of letting go of suffering and by letting go of those possessions. And sometimes these things disappear quickly. Sometimes I like to refer to my friend who, in the early 1990s, there was a big fire in the Oakland Hills. That day, she left to go to the beach, and she had her car and her driver's license. And when she came home, her house had burnt up. And her house was also her office. So everything that she had, except the car and the driver's license, were gone for her, you know, in one afternoon. So, you know, what does it mean to start over again without all the mementos and all the photographs and all the heirloom things that she had, all the kinds of, you know, her office and everything. So do we suffer or do we learn how not to suffer? And, you know, maybe a combination of both. Some people suffer around the idea of their status. And so the status has to do with where we fit into our society or among the people we care about, maybe at work. And our status can be up and down, job promotions or job losses. Not a few people, they lose their job. It isn't just the sadness of losing a job, but their whole identity of who they think they are is tied not only to the job, but also to the status the job gives in society and place. And so it's very important. And I've known people who've taken very stressful jobs, not because they like doing it, but because they were somehow dependent on the status that it seemed to give them. That they were somehow, they were successful, they were seen as successful, or they had power or authority, or they had arrived somehow in some social class or something. And so in some way or other, their identity, their sense of self, is tied to status and where they fit in. And that also can be ephemeral and can be disappear quickly. And not a few people who have had some certain status just happily, maybe or not, until the point that they retired, and then they felt lost, at loss, because that they weren't being fed, and that wasn't there for them anymore, and they felt disoriented. They say that some people actually die relatively quickly after retirement, when they're so dependent on their work for their sense of identity and well-being. And so all these things, I think, possessions, status, are not really reliable places to build up a sense of self, and they're not required. Maybe we're a lot happier if our sense of self identity is not tied to possessions or status or our particular work role or things like that. And some of that, you know, sense of identity that comes with that comes because the ideas of self that people assign to us. So like status, we assign status, people look up to us, whatever. And so it's a cooperative effort. It isn't just, we don't just do it alone, create a sense of self, but sometimes our society helps us out. Sometimes it's quite painful, right? Because things like racism, people see you a certain way and assign people a certain status in society. You didn't ask for it, but that's what's assigned to you, and it's quite painful to feel that, you know, this is not who I am. I'm not, you know, what you're telling me I am. Or sometimes people internalize the racism to themselves, and it's quite painful. And so this whole idea of self gets very painful for many people. It's very complicated, the way our social relationships build up. We're looking for each other, towards each other, for definitions of who we are, or we assign definitions to who we are to each other. And it can be a very difficult place to be. And I didn't realize this until I had children who went through grade school. How vicious some of these kids in grade school can be around these issues. And apparently at that age, girls, it can be quite, I had no idea. I was in, you know, I was playing ball. I didn't realize that girls didn't play ball so much in school. They were having these social relationships. And that's what I picked up from my kids' grade school. You know, wow, it's an intense world there. And this idea of self and, you know, comes into play quite strongly at an early age. When I was 10, I went to school in Italy. I didn't speak Italian, but I was assigned to Italian school. The first week of school, because it was a public school in Italy, it's a Catholic country, they had a priest who came to teach religion, Catholicism. And I joined the class late in the year, I sat in the back row, all the way in the back of the classroom, last seat available. I was a new kid in the class, and he called me forward to the front of the class. I remember there was a little platform. I had to stand up on this little platform in front of the class, and the priest there. He asked me what religion I was. Well, religion was hardly important for my family, and that wasn't important at all, but I knew that I had been baptized as a Lutheran. So I knew that much. So he asked me, what religion are you? And I said, Lutheran. And he said, what? So I said it again. And then he went like, with his hand, he went with like this, like I was like a little fly or something. Just go back to the back of the room. You know, so I got a little message about who I, you know, at least how he saw who I am, and, you know, how much I counted. You know, it's, we do these things to each other. So this whole social world of self and all that can be quite painful. part of what Buddhist monastics do, in theory at least, is to step out of that whole social game of self. And one of the ways that they do this, symbolically, is to shave their heads, because a fair amount of identity issues can be tied up with hair sometimes. So, but then if we get closer in, you know, one of the places that Buddhism puts a lot of emphasis on is our body. Body, being embodied, being connected to your body, living through your body, with awareness in your body. Mindfulness of the body is very important. But it's also, Buddhism likes to point out that there's a lot of suffering around identifying yourself with your body. And so, you know, this is who I am. I had a friend who went off to become a monk, a monastic at this Tassajara, the Zen Center's monastery. And she lived there for several years. The first year she got there, people there were given single rooms, little rooms, that some of them had their own little toilet and sink and mirror. And she went and got some newspaper and she taped up the mirror. And for 1 year, her practice was not to look at herself in the mirror, because she wanted to free herself from all the identity, self-identity issues that come into play when she would look in the mirror and see her hair, her face, and all that, as a way of freeing herself from that kind of involvement. You know, and we know people, maybe you're that kind of person as well, who can be very attached to your looks, how you look, or how your body seems, and somehow how your body seems to be or how it is, you build an identity or a negative identity. You build up some definition of yourself. And that definition or that identification about how important your body is and how that speaks for who you really are can cause a tremendous amount of suffering. And we do it to each other also. It's a social thing as well. People get teased. They can be criticized. They can be bullied even for how they look. And so, you know, when there's this kind of assault, you know, like from other people about how we look in our body, there's a kind of an identity that's created. And people, again, our society helps us create an identity. Oh, I must be a bad person or a wrong person or somehow not right, and that must be the truth of who I am. But, when, you know, we do it to ourselves. You know, and it starts at a very early age. I mean, I was very concerned about how high my forehead is when I was, you know, I think I remember starting at 12 or 13, I was concerned that my forehead was too high. And somehow that was really a bad thing, rather embarrassing. And I was also worried that I was going to go bald. And so the karma of that was becoming a monk and shaving my head for many years. But I used to measure the distance from my top of my nose to, with my finger, like, you know, and then it was one of the things I did in class. You know, I was in class many hours a week, and I had to do something in class. And the alternative didn't seem very interesting, so I would measure and, you know, check. And I can tell you, I still remember very well, and I can tell you happily, let you know, in case you're concerned about these issues for me, my sake, that it hasn't changed any. The distance is the same. You know, and so, but to identify strongly with your body can cause a lot of suffering. And is it really that important? And I think there's a general tendency that for people as they get older, to become less and less identified with their body as being how, what defines them. Some of you, if you have been a parent, a new parent, I've noticed a phenomenon among most new parents that I know, including myself and my wife, that it's kind of hopeless to try to be too concerned about self-grooming. You know, whether your clothes are right, you know, you just, you know, you're exhausted, and, you know, your kid is, you know, crying all your time, and it just kind of falls away, that concern, kind of in a way that just feels like sometimes a relief, you know, just not an issue. But as people get older, also sometimes some of the issues that were so important when they're younger no longer become an issue. Sometimes it becomes a bigger issue because of the culture of youth and certain kind of beauty that lives in our society. And so when we get older and we no longer have what this is considered to be the right thing, then we get this negative identity. It's kind of, we feel, oh, I'm not right anymore, because we identify with it, and other people identify us by our body and how we are. And so it can be quite painful. Some people have accidents, get sick in ways that their body gets, gets damaged in serious ways, and they look very different. Or their physical abilities change dramatically. And there's our own internal identity issues around that and what it means. We define ourselves, and also what society can do to us. It can be quite painful also and with that. And then there's learning to become free of that, to not see our body as ourself, and to be much more at ease and not use the body as a definition. This is who I really am. Not define ourselves through our body and what we look like. And not have our happiness tied to that definition or to the feedback we get from other people, any kind of plus or minus. And so the stress, you can feel the stress level, the suffering level, the anguish level, the struggle that goes on around some people and their body and how they look and how it defines them and how we have to be very careful for it. When I heard this little cliche, I was actually quite touched by this cliche. It goes something like that. Some people give more care to how they dress than to what they say. And I think probably that's true. But shouldn't it be the other way around? Shouldn't we be more careful about how we speak? Because that has a bigger impact than what we look like. So to begin to learn to not be caught in the entanglement of defining ourselves or defining other people by what they look like, by their skin color, or by their size, or by, what their body is like, and to be able to see something deeper in them is a gift to people who never are used to being defined by their body or some way or other. And it relieves a lot of suffering and stress. If we come in closer, which the Buddhist approach is to go deeper and deeper, then the next layer is around whether the things are pleasant or unpleasant. The sense of pain and pleasure that we can get through our bodies. Some people identify with that very clearly, very closely. I think it's very natural to identify very closely to it, because in a variety of different ways, after all, the pain is happening to me. The pleasure is happening to me. And so it's very personal. It kind of strikes in, you're the recipient of it, or you are it somehow. And so there's a very strong identification sometimes with pleasure and pain. Some people do this much more than others. And some people feel like if they have pain of any kind, something uncomfortable, that it's a personal failure. That somehow you're supposed to be kind of on a cloud and everything's supposed to be pleasant and relaxed and nice. And sometimes there's a very strong cult almost, or culture, of pleasure in our society. The pursuit of pleasure, of comfort, of pleasantness, of nice experiences that goes on. When I was a relatively new Zen student, one of the things that I worked with quite a bit was to free myself from being entangled with pleasure and pain, particularly through working with pain. In Zen, one of the rules of practice is when you sit and meditate with everybody else in the Zen meditation hall, you sit in a very strong, upright lotus posture, and you're not allowed to move for 40 minutes. And if you do it, 9-10 times during the day, 40 minutes without moving, the strain builds up. And so I would sit with a lot of pain, especially knee pain. And so, but you weren't supposed to move. So it was, I certainly suffered a lot around that. Sometimes it was great despair and self-pity and discouragement and animosity to the knees for being so unkind to me, and to the bell ringer who wasn't ringing the bell. And slowly I learned that these reactions of self-pity, of anger, of despair, of all these things, were not really needed. And I began to disentangle myself from the reactions I had, the responses I had to it. And the pain became simpler and simpler. And I started to kind of begin to feel that I could have the pain there without identifying with it, without relating it to myself, without making a self, without being tied to any kind of self-identity or any kind of me, myself, and mine. It was almost like the pain is free-floating and I'm watching it, or I'm separate from it, kind of like that. I remember, it wasn't just in meditation I did this. I got very interested in this phenomena. I did a lot of physical work at the Zen Center, at Green Gulch Farm, for example, and out in the fields. And I had to, you know, physical work sometimes can be quite painful. I remember, like for example, once I had to, with one other person, I had to carry this really heavy object quite a long distance. And it was kind of optional, you know, when we put it down to rest. But I found it very interesting to stay into the very strong pain period of carrying that object. It felt safe. I didn't feel like I was damaging myself. But to stay there with the intensity of it, to see if I could explore this interface between the pain and me, and how much I got entangled and identified with it, and how much I could, you know, could just let it be there free-floating and not be involved in it. And I eventually learned that I can't say that I'm good at this or always can do this, but in the right circumstances, I've had intense physical pain and joy at the same time. Not joy at the having pain. You know, please don't pursue that route. But because by decoupling my inner sense of well-being from the physical pleasure and pain, then the inner landscape had access to deeper wellsprings of deep well-being and happiness that can't happen if our inner kind of well-being is tied to the you know, sensual pleasure or sensual pain. So to free the identity from that, not because you have to, but because if you pay attention, you see that the identifying with pain and pleasure is a form of stress. And you want to free of that stress, then you want to kind of work beyond that. The next layer in Buddhism, going in closer, would be to look at the particular identifications we have around who we are. And is there stress around that? So it could be as innocent as, you know, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm a gender diverse person. You know, so you have a certain identity, this is who I am, and that could be neutral, it's fine to have any of these, but it also can be that, again, from the point of view of society and what society does to us or what we do to ourselves, there can be a lot of stress around this identity. As soon as we say, I am this, then we have to live up to certain standards or other people have certain ideas of what this means. Or we identify with a role. I am my role. I am this job. I'm this kind of, you know. And so then there can be a lot of stress around having this label. When I was in seventh grade, I took an art class, and the teacher came over to look at me while I was drawing something. And she was an authority figure in my mind. And, you know, she knows. She was the art teacher. I didn't know anything about art, but I was drawing. And she looked over my shoulder and she said, you have no artistic ability. You know, but it's okay. It was the 1960s. And so, you know, none of us, no one knew about, you know, what a horrible thing that could be done to a person. So I didn't know either. That was a horrible thing, and I didn't know. I didn't care, but I wasn't thinking. I said, okay, that's the way it is, and you know, the sky's blue, and I have no artistic ability, and that was kind of, you know, so I didn't really suffer around this, but it did become an identity. This kind of label, I am this, I have no artistic ability, and so through the rest of school, you know, just that was just the nature of the sky was blue and I have no artistic ability, and that's the way it is. Until I came to college, my freshman year in college, my roommate in college probably qualifies as a born-again artist, evangelistic artist. So he worked on me and to get me converted to the true way. At the end of that first year, I was taking art classes. And as it turned out, I had some little bit there, you know, enough to have fun and really enjoy doing the art. So there's a label, right, and we identify. So very simple identity, I am this, is something deeper inside of us than pleasure and pain. We can have a lot of suffering around that because generally anything that you say you are, a number of things can happen. One is that and you're not really static. So we're, you know, changing, shifting things all the time. And so if you're still holding on to I am this way, then that we bump up against reality. That's reality's different. Also, if we say I am this, it can be a magnet for all kinds of ideas, cultural ideas, familial ideas, personal experience ideas of what it means to be this particular thing. And it can be quite oppressive sometimes to kind of feel the magnetic pull of all these concepts, ideas of what we have to live up to because now I'm this. And, it's lovely for some people to do something like to go to some place where our ordinary identities aren't operating. Some people going backpacking in the Sierras, being away from people, and your job, your role in life, your place, your identities just don't compute up there. The bears and the raccoons don't care. And so it's some kind of ease and relaxation falls away, and it'd be quite lovely to have this fall away. And then you get back to the parking lot where you left your car, and there's people there. And you can sometimes watch the identities kind of reemerge and get recreated. People who do meditation retreats have the same experience. It's kind of lovely to have some of these identities fall away and not count. And then when they come back into their usual life, they can feel it kind of get reconstellated. In some societies, like in Japan, they have, I don't know if it's still the case, but there used to be public baths. Japan is a little bit of a stratified society where, and class differences and all that. But it's quite lovely in Japan that everyone becomes equal in the bathhouse. You know, you're all naked. And so it's a one place you get to feel what it's like to drop some of the identities, some of the roles and what goes on. So the stress around, you know, the label we have of who we are. If you go in closer, more deeply, then there's stress around identifying with how our mental activities, our mental functioning. So for example, our opinions, our thoughts. Some people are very strongly identified with their thoughts. So much so that I am my thoughts. I think, therefore I am. And the idea of not thinking is frightening to some people because they die, they disappear. Some people, as the meditation gets quieter and quieter and there's less and less thoughts, find it very challenging and threatening because their whole identity is built up through the stories and thoughts they tell themselves about who they are. And if they're not telling stories and reliving stories that reinforce their idea of who they are, it can be quite disorienting, even frightening for some people. Their sense of safety, security depends on the thoughts and ideas and concepts and story-making that kind of keeps it all going. And if you look at your content of your thoughts, what you think about, I think for many people, a high percentage of their thoughts are self-referential in nature, one way or the other. That you yourself are kind of in character of your thoughts and the stories, the conversations you're having in your mind. And in some ways, some of that is building and creating and maintaining an identity. Sometimes thoughts of, you know, delusions of grandeur, you know, sitting there and thinking about all the great things you're going to do and all the great plans you're going to do. And it reinforces a certain self-concept. To have these thoughts and these fantasies. And they have nothing to do with reality, but it's, you know, sort of seems good to be, you know, saving the world, from destruction, you know, whatever, through these great, you know, all kind of, whatever thoughts they might be. Thoughts come and go. There's stress involved in holding on to these thoughts, stress involved in maintaining them, planning and supporting them. And so if you're interested in de-stressing, you want to be able to put these kinds of thoughts down. You don't need them. You don't need to always be thinking about who you are, always be maintaining an identity. You don't need to define yourself by your thoughts, by your opinions, by your intentions, by your impulses, by your reactions you have inside. many people have a strong identity to all of this. Probably you know people. No one does this for themselves, but it's very rare that people see that they do it. But many of us know people who are opinionated. Those people. And sometimes when you see it, people have strong opinions that they're very identified with their opinions. And they're not just defending their opinion, they're defending themselves in the process. So this is all in Buddhism is called the kind of mental constructs, mental activity. And those, it's much deeper and therefore more insidious, stronger sense place where people identify. But also it creates a lot of stress to have it. And then in this kind of going in closer and closer, more intimate, the analysis that Buddhism gives, the deepest structure of self or place we identify with self has to do with consciousness. That, yes, my body is not myself, my feelings are not myself, my identities are not, you know, the names, but the labels I give myself are not myself, my mental activities, even my thoughts are not myself. All these things are ephemeral, they come and go, they're changing all the time. Yes, they don't qualify, that's not who I am, but I'm really who I am as consciousness. That's really who I am. Now, maybe, but what I've seen is that, I've done this in myself, and I've seen it in other people, that in identifying with consciousness, the very act of identification, the act of holding on to this is who I am, the kind of fixation or kind of orientation it takes to hold that in place and do that, it causes a certain degree of stress in the mind. And what happens if we don't create the identity, the consciousness is who I am? I propose my experience is actually the mind gets lighter, consciousness gets lighter, it's just easier. That as soon as we make that identity, there's a tightness, a contraction that goes on. I've also known people who get very attached to this idea that consciousness is who they are, and they're kind of annoying to be around. Because, you know, it's kind of like a very strong view, kind of spiritual view they hold on to, and they want to convince you that this is who you really are and who we really are. And it's just kind of, and Buddhists get it a lot because in Buddhism, because of this strange Buddhist concept of no self, not self, you know, and they say nothing is, consciousness is not self, then they, you know, people come with great fiery zeal and let me explain to you, you know, that consciousness really is the self. And, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but the idea that there can be this attachment to it that goes on. So in all this, what I'm trying to do is to point out is that it's not, the issue is not whether any of these things are accurate or not, or whether these things are the self or not the self. The main concern is there stress involved in identifying any of these areas of our life, or is there suffering involved in identifying these as the self or taking them as being mine? And if you're tuning into the Buddhist approach is to tune into the stress, if what you want is to be free of that stress, tune into where there's suffering so you can relax and become free of that suffering. And so as a result, then the tendency is to no longer get involved, get attached to our possessions itself, our status as who we really are. Not to get attached to the body as who we really are, our feelings, our labels, our mental activities, and even consciousness, not to take that as, this is who I really am. And then to at some point realize that it's actually most peaceful to not take anything as myself. And so that release and relaxation that leads the Buddha to say that these things, body, feelings, labels, mental activities, consciousness, they don't really qualify as a reliable self to get attached to and hold on to. They're not satisfactory. They don't offer lasting satisfaction. Identifying with them as being me doesn't lead to lasting satisfaction and peace. And so the not-self teaching in Buddhism is not a teaching that there is no self, but rather a teaching that the body is not a satisfying place to get attached to self. So it's not, the body is not the real self. The feelings are not the real self. Your labels about yourself are not the real self. The mental activities you have is not the real self. The consciousness is not the real self. So then the question is, who are we really? If all those things don't really qualify as a good place to hang the hat of self. And then the Buddha said, well, the very question of asking, who are you really? What's the true self? Is stressful. And maybe it's not needed. Maybe we don't need to answer the question, who are you? Maybe there's a kind of freedom that can come without identifying anything as being the true self, who I really am. And then the question is, can you function successfully in the world without a very clear attachment or clear sense, this is who I really am? You can if you have a clear sense of being in your body and know what's going on in your body. You can if you have a clear sense of what the experiences of pleasure and pain that goes on in the body. They're very important, those experiences. They're kind of teachers for us to help us understand better what's going on. We can if we have a clear sense of the labels and perceptions we have in our mind. We can if we have very clear mindfulness of what goes on in our thoughts, in our impulses, in our intentions. It helps to have a very clear sense of something that's called consciousness or awareness and how it operates and how it's here. It's possible to function we need to have the more we are clearly aware of how these things operate and are connected to them, the more successful we can operate in the world. And the more we kind of be aware of the world, the more we know ourselves well, we can track ourselves, we can monitor ourselves, we can connect to our intentions, and our wisdom, our compassion. And with connected to all these things, it's not really so important that we have a clear idea of who we really are as a self. We can be free of self-preoccupation that way, with possessiveness that way, with strong identification that way. We might have identities that we live by, but there's a difference between identities and identification. Identification is an action that the mind makes. We identify. It's a verb. We are identifying with something. An identity is just something we have. So I have an identity of being a man, usually, but I can identify with being a man, and that adds a lot of extra stuff on top of it, because then I'm actively involved in that creating and making that identity. So the Buddhist approach is that it's possible to live in the world much more successfully, much more happily and peacefully, without picking up this idea of this is the self. And so the way this is worded in Buddhism is not by not saying that there is no self. And so you don't have to argue with anyone that, you know, defend or criticize Buddhism for saying there's no self. But Buddhism is very particular. It says certain things that we can experience and be present for don't qualify or can't be characterized, used to characterize this is who I really am. So the teaching is not self-teaching. The body is not self. Feelings are not self. Labels are not self. Mental activities are not self. Consciousness is not self. And then relax. Does that make sense? So I hope that makes some sense. I hope that did more to clarify than make it more complicated. But the one thing that I wanted to get across, which I've said twice already, I think, and that is that the starting point is not the philosophy about what is not the self, but rather the entry point to this whole conversation is to recognize where the suffering, the stress is. And if you start there, then a very different path is taken. And it's a path that will help you find how to suffer less and less around the whole notion of self. And if in the end of that path you identify a true self, this is who you truly are, and now you know for sure, don't get attached to it, because then you'll suffer. And then finally, I know I said finally. How many times can I say finally? Last thing. I find that this process of mindfulness that helps us to shed all these unnecessary attachments to self that goes on is a very generous thing to do to yourself. It's like a gift to yourself, because in the end of doing it, you get to be more yourself. When we identify anything as being myself, we actually limit ourselves and become less. But when we, paradoxically, when we let go of self-concepts and self-identities, we actually can radiate and shine more who we actually are. There's no inhibition, there's no definition, there's no boundaries, there's no putting ourselves in a box. So rather than losing yourself, being diminished by this teachings of not-self, it's actually a form of being enhanced, kind of being fuller as a person. But it's safe because you're not going to get conceited from being more yourself. You'll just be. Okay, I should stop. Thank you.